Welcome back. This is Ruby Tuesday. I'm Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth. And today, we're going to talk about youth football. Specifically, we're going to talk about one of the hottest and I think most important questions in all of sports. Should your child play football? Now, I published a long feature story on this question last week. If you're weighing this decision, if you're thinking about having your kid play or having your kid play again for another season, I really recommend you go to our website, check out the story. It's called The Choice. I learned a lot reporting and writing it. I think it'll give you a lot to think about. And one thing I know for sure is that there is a whole lot to consider when you're trying to make this decision. In fact, there's so much to consider that I needed to get backup. So that's why I have today's guest on. His name is Dustin Fink. He's a certified athletic trainer. He lives and works in Central Illinois. He also runs the Concussion blog, which in my estimation, and the estimation of a lot of smart people who work in this field, is one of the best places online for unbiased and frankly very practical information on what's happening in the world of sports and traumatic brain injuries. Dustin, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Patrick. I appreciate you having me on, and thanks for those very flattering words.
Well, no, you deserve them. The website is great, and like I said, any parent would be well served to check it out, go through the archives, go through some of the really good resources you've put on there. Like I said, it's not just that you have good information. It's super accessible, and this is a complex topic, so that's actually something that is sometimes hard to find. I want to start off by asking, you know, you've been a trainer for what, about 15 years now?
That's my 14th year as of getting paid for it, yeah, but if you include the previous six as a student athletic trainer, we're 20 now, 20 years.
Wow, so that's good. So you've got 20 years of experience. I want to know, when it comes to football specifically and brain damage and kids, how concerned do you think people are out there that you deal with, that you work with every day, parents especially, and how has that changed over the last 5-6 years?
It's changed considerably, Patrick, over the last 5 or 6 years. You know, when I first got into athletic training as a professional, working with high schools, even I, coaches, parents, we really didn't think a lot about concussions. Heck, the standard of care was kid gets dinged up, tells you dizzy, has a headache, everything else. You come to the sideline, say, hey, have a seat for 15 minutes. You go back to him 15 minutes later, and they say, yeah, I'm fine. You put him right back to play because that was a standard of care. So it's changed, you know, 14 years later, we're way more sensitive about it, as practitioners, and so are parents. Now, the parents, have been a little bit slower, to react to this only because, you know, maybe not every parent has somebody that's playing sports or has a concussion. So, you know, the likelihood of them encountering this issue and the changes that have occurred with it are lower than the general population, but yet we're starting to see a culture shift in terms of acceptance of the injury. And there's much more to be done, but to answer your question, it's changed quite a bit.
Do you feel, you know, I want to pick up on something you just said. Do you feel at the youth level, again, with the people you deal with, because you're out in the field every day, do you find that people, until something happens to them, like their child gets a concussion, maybe someone they know pretty well, child gets a concussion, do you find that people still aren't really getting a lot of information that they would need in terms of the subject? Like, even, I mean, because, you know, working in the media and working on this subject myself for a couple of years, I feel saturated, you know, and I'm sure you do too. And I think a lot of people, those of us who pay regular attention to this, probably feel a little saturated. But I'm just wondering for the actual, you know, again, people out there who are parents whose job is not to follow this, do you find that they're still not really getting a lot of just the basics of what's happening, why this is important, what they need to consider?
Yeah, I think your point is very spot on. For the most part, if it doesn't happen to them or somebody they're affected, they're really not seeking out the information. Although that's changing too, at least where I'm at. I try to do the best I can to educate all parents about the issues of concussions. So in the past, I've done parent meetings before seasons and just talked about all injuries. And that's the other thing that we need, you know, that we need to kind of touch on, especially when it comes to athletic trainers. Our job isn't necessarily just for concussions.
Sure.
Our job's for all injuries. So we talk about it all, and then, you know, it's more of a candid conversation, and at least the information's getting out there. And now in Illinois, at least, and I think most other states, there's a mandate that parents and kids have to read and sign an information waiver regarding concussions. How much they absorb of that, I don't know, but at least the information is being handed to them. So now they're getting some information. So it's changed considerably. It could be better, like anything else. It can always be better. And I think we're trying our best to do what we can to educate those. And it takes work. You know, not everybody's going to seek out the information. You know, there's good information, whether it's at your fingertips or on TV or whatnot, or newspapers. There's good information from time to time. But to really fully grasp the issue of concussions, you're going to have to read about it, because like anything else in life, taking a snapshot doesn't necessarily paint the entire picture.
Right. And, you know, that's the biggest single reason why I wanted to have you on today, is to get some of that information across. You know, anyone listening to this, like I said, who's a parent who's trying to make this choice, make this decision, you know, should my child, in most cases going to be son, play tackle football? I think, you know, this question and this choice, I think it kind of is happening at two levels. We've got the practical level, where it's an individual question for parents and families. And then there's sort of that larger, bigger picture ethical question for our public education system and society. We got a dog there in the background.
Yeah,
dog. So I'm a little excited there.
Yeah, he's way excited. I'm good.
All right, that's okay. That's, like I said, this is what podcasting is all about.
Absolutely. Why not keep it you know, real, for as they say. Let's keep exactly. It real for our audience out
that's
here.
That's right. So I want to start with sort of that individual side of it. And then towards the end of this, we'll get into sort of that bigger picture stuff. Obviously forever with football, because it is, you know, it is a physical, and I hate that because I feel it's euphemistic, it's a violent sport. It's a collision sport. The collisions aren't accidents, you know, it's intentional. And in a very fundamental way, you know, there's a reason people wear armor in football. And football is, at its core, is about physically dominating the person across the line of scrimmage from you, which means you're inflicting, you know, you're inflicting pain on them. You're inflicting harm in a lot of cases. So there's always been a risk and reward with football, right? Even before we had much, like you talked about how we didn't have a lot of knowledge necessarily of what's going on, concussions and brain damage, you know, years ago that we have now. There's always been this risk-reward calculation. Now, I think the rewards, I think, are pretty obvious at this point. I mean, football is fun, for one. You know, people that like to play, they like to play because it's fun. There's tons of community spirit and pride around football teams. We really value football playing ability in America. In a lot of places, playing youth football, especially high school football, it's almost a rite of passage. It's a part of how people develop their identity, and especially a lot of places, their masculine identity. There's a lot of cultural baggage on the sport there. It's a good way, if you're a kid, to be popular in high school. It'll help you get in physical shape. And if you're really good, you're a really gifted athlete, you might be able to play in college, the NFL, and actually get paid in some way to play. So I think the rewards are well known. They're in front of our faces all the time. On the other side of the ledger, though, the risk, it's changed now because of brain damage. It's more serious, but it's also sort of more mysterious and invisible in a lot of ways. It's not like tearing up your knee or separating your shoulder. And it's a recent thing, like you said, that we're starting to become aware of this as a society. And we're aware that this can happen even though you're wearing a helmet. So this is a long way to set up a really simple question, which is, if I'm a parent and I come to you, what can you tell me about that risk? What do I need to know? What are sort of the basic things I need to know?
You kind of summarized it all about the sport itself, and I think most people understand it. It's a collision sport, and the point is to actually run into somebody and cause a collision. And anytime we're having collisions, or anytime we're playing sport or life in general, there's going to be risks, and it's always going to be greater. It's going to be a greater risk when the actual objective is to tackle somebody.
Right.
So if, as a parent, if you came to me and asked me, what are the major risks, or what do I really need to know about football from my perspective?
And also in terms of concussions and brain damage,
correct,
particularly.
Correct.
Yeah. What do I need to know?
If we're speaking concussions only, what you need to understand as a parent, and what everybody needs to understand that's listening, is that concussion, the injury, although is something we take very seriously and something we need to recognize and make sure we take care of, that is not the massive issue. It's the actual management of the injury. And the issue that I feel that most parents fail to look at is that once your son or daughter has a concussion, it's the proper management of that concussion that will result in quick recovery, safe recovery, and you know, some you know, just general injury recovery with no long-term effects. Now, that's not proven yet, but what we have been doing in the past for management of concussions is coming into question now. So as a parent, you need to understand that once they are injured, it's getting and seeking the proper medical attention for the concussion and treating it properly. I think as an athletic trainer, there are more concussions now, whether that's because people are more aware of it and they're telling me, or I'm seeing more of them. That might be one issue. Another issue might be that the kids that play sports today, whether they're male or female, are bigger, faster, and stronger. Mm-hmm. Collisions happen, and things happen, whether it's in football or other sports, that cause the head to be jarred, and that's causing a concussion. And you know, the million-dollar question that I get from parents a lot of times is, well, back in my day, why wasn't this happening? Why weren't we seeing the same issues? And my answer is ever-changing with that, but the best way I can say and try to verbalize an answer for that question is simply saying, well, there were less people playing sports 25, 30 years ago than there are now. There was less sports specialization. In particular, football, there was less youth football. And one of the other major factors was that if you got dinged up in playing sports 25, 30 years ago, although the impetus was to put you back in, you weren't being hit with the same amount of force that you're being hit with now. And a lot of times you self-protected your interest at the time. So maybe you didn't go running 150 miles an hour into a tackle after you were already dinged up because you knew you were banged up already.
But the pressures have changed
and the expectations have changed of the athlete.
Yeah, and I think you made a good point there. One of the things I think parents need to know is that, like you said, one of the things we know for sure, there's a lot we still don't know about the brain, about concussions and how they work, and it's very hard. We know some general things, but every individual injury can be very different. But one of the things we seem to know for sure is that if you have been concussed already, it's a very bad idea, and it greatly raises your risk of continuing or worse injury to get out there and be hit in the head again while you're still recovering from that first concussion. And so
that is very true. And that's right. Something that we didn't quite realize many years ago. But you know, the question was always, well, these concussions were happening years ago, but we weren't seeing the incidents of sudden death that we're seeing now in relation to heads and brain bleeds and stuff like that. So why was that? And It's tough to try and figure that out. You know, I keep going back to the size of athletes and the speed of athletes and the amount of force in one of these collisions on the football field now. It's just so much greater than it was back then. And even the old school people will tell you, yeah, the kids are much bigger, faster, and stronger today than they were when they were kids. And I think that has a lot to do with it.
I think you're right. I think the other thing is it's not just force, because one thing I should also point out is we have, like, people that study this, they haven't been able to find like a really solid threshold for, you know, how much force, you know, in terms of what we can measure, in terms of G-force, when we put sensors on helmets and try to measure this, does it actually take to give someone a concussion or not give someone a concussion? There is no real answer to that. Sometimes you can get a hit of 100 Gs, which measured at 100 Gs, which is like a severe car crash, and someone can get up and seem to be fine. There doesn't seem to be any concussive effect. Other players could get hit at like 20 Gs, which is still bad, but far, far, far less, and be concussed. So The people that study that haven't been able to really pin down. Obviously, they know that greater force is more risky, but it's not as simple as saying, oh, if you get hit at this level, you're going to be concussed, and if you get hit below this, you won't. It doesn't really work that way, which is one of the really mysterious things about it, and one of the things that makes it hard for researchers, actually. I just wanted to point that out, so people who are listening will have an idea about that. I think we should talk about, before we get into the what you need to know after the point of your child being concussed, let's talk about the things that we can do to reduce the risk of concussions and also other types of brain damage that are also potentially there. I think the single biggest thing, and I'm not saying this to pump up your profession, but the single biggest thing I think that can be done today is extremely practical and also probably reduces the most amount of risk is simply having a trainer on hand for every game and every practice where you have hitting and tackling. And a trainer who knows, who's had some training specifically in concussion recognition and management. How important do you think that simple step is?
I mean, obviously it's biased coming from
Well, sure,
me
but
as
that's
an athletic
okay. But
trainer, but
tell me how and why that's important.
it's important because athletic trainers are trained. That's redundant. Athletic trainers are trained in concussion assessment and recognition, as well as management of concussions as well. So, our job is essentially, as an athletic trainer, whether it be concussions or anything else, our job is player safety, and having an athletic trainer around for collision sports takes the conflict of interest away from a coach. For many years, and even still today, coaches that become coaches through the national certification, they have to take a first aid training portion of the test, because for years it's been the coach's ultimate responsibility to look out for player safety, and it still is. It's still ultimately the coach's responsibility, but the athletic trainer who is trained in injury, all injury recognition and prevention and management and rehabilitation, it's our job to let the coach coach, and it's our job to deal with the medical side of things that happen in sports. So it's not only something good for the kids, but it's great for the coaches too, because they don't have to worry about that anymore. They don't have to tape ankles before a game when they're trying to prepare for a game. If a kid rolls an ankle, he doesn't have to spend time on the sidelines while his offense is out there and he's supposed to be watching that, assessing an injury. That's what our job is. That's what we do. Athletic trainers, there's a report, I forget where it appeared, but there was a research report regarding injuries at practices and games. Having an athletic trainer and not having an athletic trainer identified significantly more injuries. But even though there was more injuries found, the return to play was quicker by having an athletic trainer with them at practices or games. So we're able to identify it early and take care of it early and get them back to where they need to be. Concussions also, you see more concussions with an athletic trainer naturally because we're trained in it. We're going to see it more. It's just like a doctor that's trained, that might work in an emergency room department, but has been trained to do cardiovascular stuff. He's going to probably, he or she's going to pick up more cardiovascular type issues in emergency room department admissions than a generally trained ER doc or maybe even a PA or whatever else. So you get what they're trained for, and that's our job. So that's why you need an athletic trainer. It'll only help to protect the kids. It's our sole job to do that. We're not coaches. We're not, in some places we are teachers, but you know, after school we separate ourselves and we do what we're charged to do, what we're trained to do, what we take a national certification to do, and what allied health professionals ask us to do, because we're fellow allied health professionals, and that's protect the kids.
I'm glad you said that because I think people, especially parents, need to realize, first of all, what you said about coaches. Worst case scenario, you have some sort of crazy win at all costs youth coach, which, let's be honest, there are people like that out there, hopefully not too
Yes.
many, who really don't give a damn about their players' health to the extent that it will make it harder for them to win, and that kind of person might put your kid in harm's way, might put your concussed child back into a game before they shouldn't be. But I think on the other side of it, it's probably much more common. You have plenty of coaches who are good people, really care about kids. They don't want anyone getting hurt. If someone gets hurt, they want them off the field. But let's be honest, you said they're football coaches. Like, not only are they not trained at this, but they got a million other things to pay attention to. They are out there trying to coach and win a game. It's, in my opinion, very unfair to put the burden on them of concussion recognition, especially because, and I think you alluded to this too, concussions are very hard sometimes to recognize. They're not. It's not like someone breaking their arm or blowing out their knee, where it's obvious. Sometimes someone's staggering around, throwing up, and it's pretty. Or they are knocked out cold, and it's pretty clear something here is wrong. It's very likely a concussion. But sometimes it's not at all that simple. It can be a very subtle injury. It can be hard even for people who are trained to sometimes spot this injury. The other thing that I think is important to have a trainer along those same lines is relying on players to self-report.
Yes.
I think it's very difficult for two reasons. I think one, you know, football culture is about playing through pain and playing through when you want to come off the field and playing through certain types of injuries that, you know, not all, but certain types of injuries. That's kind of the ethos of the sport. If you didn't have that, it'd be very hard to play an entire football game.
Correct.
But because of that, people have always traditionally treated concussions the same way. They're kind of macho about them, for lack of a better term. But the second part is, I think that this is, to me, the scarier part is, well, how do you know you're injured? Well, your brain tells you, right? Your brain is where your self-awareness comes from. Well, if your brain is injured, you don't always know. Like, people who are concussed often don't know that something's wrong. And I think that that's especially where that trainer being there on the sideline who knows the kids, who spends a lot of time with them, who can even pick up on subtle differences, not just obvious differences, can be invaluable to your kid's health.
That's exactly correct. And the other, to play off of that too, the other thing, the athletic trainer is neutral or should be neutral. And we can discuss that if you want to later time. But the athletic trainer should be neutral and should be somebody that's easily approached by the players to take care of their stuff. Right. Now, yes, of course, there are kids that come to you with what they think is a massive problem or, you know, the end of the world hangnail that's going to pull them out of a game. And it might be the athletic trainer's responsibility to calm their nerves, tell them it's okay, and they can continue playing and go on. But that's what we're trained to do. So that's the other aspect of having an athletic trainer on the sidelines.
No, that's a great point. And like you said, being neutral is a great point too. I mean, I know I saw a recent report. It was in the Chronicle of Higher Education by a friend of mine, Brad Wolverton, a great reporter. They did a survey of a lot of Division I football trainers. And I don't remember the exact percentage, but it was a fairly high percentage. I think it was close to like 30-40%. Talked about how they really didn't feel totally comfortable or totally in charge, that ultimately the coach kind of made the call on whether concussed players could or couldn't be pulled. And it was sort of a disturbing conflict of interest there that doesn't need to exist. And I think if you're a parent and if you're looking at college football for your child, if you're looking at high school football, or even youth football, don't just look for that trainer. Make sure that trainer has autonomy from the coach. Make sure that they don't have a relationship where the coach is ultimately telling the trainer what to do. You want that trainer to be independent.
That's absolutely correct, and that's a culture issue as well, and that's mainly with the bigger, more prestigious type universities, right, as well as, you know, professional sports. Right. The athletic trainer doesn't make the money that the players or coaches make, so if they don't have the support from the administration, it's going to be hard for them to quote-unquote lay down the law when it comes down to injuries.
Right. You're basically, wherever there's a much greater pressure to win football games, and that's kind of the whole bottom line of what's going on, you're going to obviously have more pressure for injured players to get back on the field faster, potentially when they're not ready. You're going to have pressure for injuries to be overlooked, all those kinds of things, because you've got winning is such a bottom line. And like you said, that's probably a problem for bigger time things. But look, even at the high school level and even at some youth teams, they're kind of big time. There are some places where that pressure to win is immense. You know, I'm thinking of places in Texas where I know it's kind of stereotypical, but look, when you've got like a $90 million, $60 million high school football stadium and the whole community is obsessed with the football team, there is a lot of pressure on you to win there. You might have a similar type of situation potentially.
Absolutely. And it even happens at the youth level in the small areas. I've worked on sidelines of youth football games of fifth and sixth graders where a parent coach thinks that what he know he or she knows about you know, sports medicine trumps what I have to know, and because all in the sake because they need to win. I mean, the comments I hear, I got to have him back on the field or we can't win. He's got to be back out there. There's nothing wrong with him. He's got to play. I have nobody else that can play quarterback. I have nobody else that can be running back. I've heard it all. I've heard it from big time and small time, from youth sports to high school sports, on the sidelines of colleges. I've heard it everywhere. It happens. It's just it happens less where the pressure is less. That is correct.
Right, and that's probably, you know, I often roll my eyes when I hear that, you know, the real whole problem here is we have to change the culture. You know, Roger Goodell says this all the time. And actually, there's a great moment in the book, League of Denial, where a parent actually asks them, well, what do you mean change the culture? I don't really understand. And eventually he just admits, you know, I can't really tell you what it means, but, you know, I appreciate your concern here. So it's one of these things where it sounds nice, but it's really vague. But I do think one place where you could legitimately talk about changing culture with all of this is make winning football games less important and make health more important. Now, that again, that kind of cuts against the culture of football as we've known it for as long as both of us have been alive. But to make things safer, that does actually have to change. Now, I want to ask you about some other risk reduction strategies that we are starting to see. The most obvious one is playing – well, the most obvious one would be don't play football. But if you're going to play, play less of it. And what I mean by that is have less collisions and hitting. So we're seeing a lot of places, they are reducing the amount of hitting they're doing in practice. You see that at the NFL level. You see that at some college conferences. You're seeing that at Pop Warner. I think some high schools coaches are adopting that like on an individual basis. To me, that seems like a really obvious kind of thing, especially when we have seen places where it doesn't actually, A, affect teams' ability to tackle and be good at football, but B, it doesn't necessarily put players in any kind of danger because they haven't learned how to tackle or protect themselves. Now, I will say there is some controversy and conflict within the field of people that study this. Some people maintain, no, if you don't spend time learning that, you're putting yourself at more risk. And other people say, no, that's not true. Just less hitting is always better. Do you have a feel about that? Do you come down on one side or the other there?
I'm a big proponent of exposure limitation, as you call or as you're describing. Mm-hmm. I get both sides of the conversation about if you really don't need it or yes, you do need it. I completely understand. I can see as an athletic trainer, honestly, that if you've never ever been around the game of football and you've never tackled anybody and we throw you out into practice, you're probably going to get hurt. But I think that has more to do with my personal opinions. I think that more has to do with understanding the game and the fundamentals of the game, not necessarily tackling somebody. Right. Granted, we don't want somebody dropping their head and going in and bashing because they've never tackled before, but that's correctable stuff that can be done in practice in a controlled situation, where hitting is not all the way through the man, all the way to the ground type of thing, which is where some of this exposure limitation can also include. So, yes, there's definitely validity on both sides of that. But overall, reducing the amount of collisions and force to your brain over time is not only logically correct, but it's also physiologically correct. I mean, it's just simple. It's a no-brainer.
No pun intended, right?
Yeah. No, I intended that pun.
Okay.
But it is a no-brainer, and it should be done. And you're right. It has been obvious. At least the schools I've been around here in Illinois over the past 14 years, they've realized it over time. The amount of hitting I have seen in high school football practices in the schools that I've been around for the past 14 years has reduced naturally. Over time, the coaches started recognizing their kids just weren't fresh enough, or they were losing kids in practices here and there after these big old long 3-hour football mashups, and they stopped doing them. And now you see the current example I have at my high school, and the coach has installed it here, is he has hitting on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, and the full contact hitting period is maybe 20 minutes on each of those days. Maybe. I would say with that, our tackling improved throughout the season. And a lot of that was done because we'd have 15-minute tackling periods on either side of the full contact that were controlled and what we call thud-type practices, where it was more form and fit and stuff like that. So I've seen it in practical application. It works. And I've seen people, coaches, understand without being told that it's probably not good to drill my kids. Now, maybe bigger schools that have more kids and more bodies and more leeway, I'm sure they feel like they can ramp it up. And even the coach I currently work with, he said if he had more bodies, he might do some more hitting in practices. It wouldn't be extreme, but he would do a little bit more, and that's because he has more bodies. So, yes, exposure limitation, I'm a big fan of, but I also understand the fears that people have, but I think those fears are being completely overblown by tradition and culture.
Right, versus, the idea that, like, yes, this is the only way to be tough,
correct,
and to be macho. Yeah.
Correct.
No, I think you're right. And, you know, it is something where if something's been done for a long time, and that's the way it's always been done, and that's how it's been handed down and passed down, it isn't easy for people to change. Like, that's one thing that, you know, that's if you learn to do something a certain way and it worked out for you relatively well, now you're trying to teach it to somebody else, and a third party is coming in and saying, oh, no, the way you're doing it is wrong. It's not necessarily easy to trust that that's correct. So I even though I don't agree, I get why people are reluctant. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Real quick, I mean, great, I don't know if it's not really a proverb, but a great saying that a buddy of mine's dad said, and I put it on the blog the other day, is, you'll always be what you've always been if you always do what you always did. And
I like that.
And that's currently what is going on. We're always going to be in this concussion issue. We're always going to do what we've always done. So we need to change it. And forced change isn't fun. I'm not big on forced change. I'm not big on legislation. I'm not big on that. I'm a small government guy myself. But sometimes there's need for it.
Right.
and even though there's only, honestly, I think it's probably, 25% or less of coaches and people and parents that don't truly understand the issues that we're facing with concussions. Maybe it's a little more, maybe it's a little less.
Right.
But that's still a lot of people that it's affecting. And to hammer home the idea and make sure that we're all serious about this, sometimes stuff like that has to be put in place.
No, I agree. And I think you actually have seen, I think there are a few states that have actually legislatively moved toward limiting, whether it was actually state law, or you see sometimes state high school federations, sort of with their own bylaws, have been limiting the amount of hitting that goes on in practice. And I think going forward, people always ask me, well, what's going to happen in the future? I just think you'll see a whole lot more of that.
I think if you want to say football, you better see more of that. I'm honest.
And
you've seen that in my writings and how I talk about. I want to say football more than anybody else. I got hammered on Twitter the other night because I got accused of trying to kill the sport. That's the exact opposite of what I want to do. I want to keep the sport around. And if we're not proactive about it and we're reactive about it, it's going to get in the hands of lawyers and insurances, and we're not going to have it.
Right. I mean, look, I get accused of all that all the time because of what I write about, too, that I want to kill the sport. And I always tell people, no, I don't want to kill a sport or not kill a sport. I want people to get honest, unbiased information and be able to think clearly about the choices they're making, clearly about the risks, and clearly about the awards, and sort of not be spun by parties that are interested in the status quo, interested in necessarily making money off a sport, which is, we'll get to that a little later, but that's one of the things I think that's hard for parents, is that there's a lot of conflicting messages out there from self-interested groups. But like I said, we'll get to that in a minute. I want to ask you about something else that's a proposed risk reduction thing that is, I think, much more controversial. And I'm kind of on the side of thinking that this is mostly not helpful, which is the quote-unquote safer tackling techniques. That the real problem here in football is that we've gotten away from the basics and the fundamentals of tackling, and we can teach people to tackle in a way that keeps their head out of the game. And that's what Roger Goodell has said. That's what the NFL has pushed through their youth football arm, USA Football, this thing called heads-up tackling. They purport that, you know what, we can make these collisions so much safer if people just do them properly. Now, again, I've talked to college football players. I've talked to former NFL players about this. I've thought about sort of the basic physics and biology that goes on in an actual football game as opposed to a tackling drill. I don't think that this is much, if any, of a panacea, and I think in some ways it's going to give people a false sense of reassurance. That's where I stand. I've written about this, so if you're interested in what I think, you can go online and look that up. But I understand there are people that disagree with me. Again, I'm kind of wondering, what do you think about this?
I'm not on the fence with this in terms of USA football. I think what they've done in terms of educating the public and those that choose to play the sport about head injuries, I think what they've done is wonderful. But I think in terms of this heads up tackling technique that they're stressing nowadays, I'm like you. If you think about it, and as Mark Schlereth says, we're not turtles. We don't go in to make a tackle and then our head retracts below our shoulders. It doesn't happen. The head is always going to follow the shoulders, and we're not going to chest bump people to make tackles. It's not sumo wrestling to make tackles. To tackle, you got to wrap up. You got to fit and rip, as they say, right?
And you have
And
to, I mean,
yeah,
physics, the basic physics, you have to get lower. You have to get leverage. So whether I'm blocking or tackling you, Dustin, like if we're coming at each other, whether we're coming from a standstill, 3-point stance, a line of scrimmage, or we're in the open field coming at each other, if I have to take you down, basically I have to get lower than you. And if you want to get past me, you have to get lower than me. I mean, unless you're this incredible going to hurdle over me, which you rarely see.
I'm not doing that. No, I
Right, if you're
can't.
gonna pull an Sean Moreno on me, okay, but that's you don't see that very often in football. That's why it's a highlight when it happens. But if I got to get lower than you, I got to drop my shoulders, and if I'm gonna do that, my head is gonna follow. It's just sort of like you said, we're not. That's a great quote from Schiff. We're not turtles. We're not little Lego men. We can't like unscrew our heads and put them aside when we have to make these kind of moves. And so, the head is always, I think, gonna always be, very much in the line of fire for getting hit, no matter how you're teaching tackling. The other concern I have with this heads-up technique is that we don't really have any data to support whether or not it makes things safer. And I always wonder if there's potentially unintended consequences. I mean, what if it ends up making things more dangerous because you're not protecting your head or your neck? And again, I'm not sure. I don't think they're trying to go out there intentionally and teach something that would be more dangerous, but there's not a lot of sort of evidence one way or the other, and it's being pushed as if there is. And that really concerns me.
And it's concerning to me too. I mean, to take the other side just for a second, because I like to look at everything from both sides.
Please do.
I think USA football with the heads up tackling technique is a wonderful idea in terms of education, but I also think it teaches the right thing to very young football players. And the collisions that happen at that level, although we've had Virginia Tech studies that have shown us that their collisions are just as great as college players, just not as many of them, although
Right.
those collisions are less frequent and is less powerful, learning and understanding to try and avoid using the head as a weapon is perfect. I think that's a great idea because we shouldn't be using our head as a weapon, and too often we see it as using as a head as a weapon.
You know, I agree with that part of it. If you can get people to not think of their head as a battering ram, that's probably good. But I don't think many players like intentionally use that because that by itself is always dangerous, even if you're wearing a helmet, because you could break your neck.
But the thing is that players do use it, maybe unintentionally. Sometimes I see running backs use their head intentionally every game, whether it's NFL or anything else, high school. So I think the head being used as a weapon, that's where football's getting this all wrong. Football needs to acknowledge that the head is part of the game. And we need to stop using it as a weapon. The NFL has done a good job so far of enforcing and really putting into place the defenseless receiver thing. But they need to attack the offensive side too. They need to get rid of the running backs that drop their head and use it as battering ram. They said they were going to do it this year. They fined a few running backs for it, but I have yet to see a flag in a game for it, although I see it all the time. So you can't take the head out of the game. They need to understand the head cannot be removed from the game. They need to acknowledge that the head's not going to be removed from the game, but you can stop using your head as a weapon. And that's where it needs to trend to, in my opinion. It just needs to say, hey, listen, Head's part of the game. When you tackle somebody, we're going to tackle somebody, we want our face mask up, but we still got to get the head across what they call the bow or in front of the ball carrier or whoever. You have to get your head to stop the momentum going forward. So it's going to be there, but you need to fit, rip, and bring them down. And you need to do that in a manner that's going to both protect your neck and the best way possible protect your brain. Now, you're not always going to protect your brain, and that's another thing that I think a lot of people are getting confused. There's not enough verbiage saying, listen, we're doing this to help protect your head and heads up football, but you're still going to possibly get concussions because the head is part of the game. They're not acknowledging the injury. And again, this goes back to where we started this conversation today. The concussion itself is not the issue. It's the mismanagement of the concussion once they're concussed that is the issue.
Let me ask you one more thing along the lines of not acknowledging or just what people don't understand. I find so many people have faith that there's going to be sort of the development of a magical football helmet that solves this problem. But if you talk to anybody who studies the brain, they will tell you there can and will never be such a thing. Because basically, long story short, the brain is like a blob of jello, essentially. It floats inside your skull. And when you're hit in the head, or even when you just change momentum suddenly, the brain stretches and pulls and moves inside of your skull and also hits the bony inside of your skull. That's where we're seeing concussions and other kinds of brain damage take place. It's kind of like an egg yolk inside a shell. You can put Kevlar around a shell, and you could, in theory, I could shoot a gun at that egg, and the bullet won't break the shell, but the yolk is still going to move around. And that's why the magic helmet isn't going to work. Do you find that you run to people who just think, okay, we just need better high-tech helmets and everything will be fine?
Yes, and a lot of people think the answer is going to be in the helmet. And I've got friends in the helmet maker industry, and they'll be the first to tell you that they can't stop concussions, and had they been able to, they would have already been discovered.
Of course, yeah.
And, I mean, it's $1 billion if they could figure that out. So the other analogy I always think about, I've never even said it till this point, so you're getting my breaking thoughts right here on the Ruby Tuesday.
All right, breaking news.
Put a helmet on a roller coaster rider anytime, a very quick switching back and forth type roller coaster, and see if the dizziness or the sometimes you get off the roller coaster, you feel uneasy and queasy, or maybe even have some vision issues or anything else like that after a roller coaster, especially one that gets whipped back and forth very quickly. Put a helmet on a roller coaster rider of such roller coaster and see if the symptoms that you had go away. They won't. It won't. And that's essentially what's happening when you play sports. With these collisions, is you're taking these unanticipated or sometimes anticipated blows that are shifting that jello inside of your skull from side to side. And when it's shifted, it's not exactly science fiction, break apart, come right back together. There's microscopic damage that's done. We're not banning roller coasters anytime soon, so I don't see us banning football anytime soon. So, but it's essentially that. It's not going to take a helmet. It may take a helmet mixed with, my thoughts on this are, and I'm sure there's some innovators listening that will take this and run with it, and hopefully they can do something with it. But my thoughts are, if you look at racing, although they have more force-absorbing type helmets that are one use, so once they get in a wreck, they can't use them again, which is not applicable on, say, football or hockey, they also have the Hans device, which right. also stops the head from shifting around and going back and forth. Also, inside those, you don't see a lot of racers with concussions. You really don't. As many of those collisions they get into and the quick starts and stops and whatever else and the whipping back and forth that they do, like on Formula One and whatever else, you don't see concussions because it's, one, the Hans device, two, a little bit of the helmet, but three, when they're racing, their head is inside their little driver's seat. It stops it from moving from side to side. So that's why you don't see a lot of concussions. Even in those massive collisions, you don't see a lot of concussions.
Right.
Very rarely does it happen. So that's what it needs to happen. That's about the only change that could be made. It's going to have to be something that's attached to the to the shoulder pads. It's going to help stop the movement. But then again, if you're stopping the movement from a collision, are you stopping the movement, free range of motion movement that you need to play the sport?
Right.
So there's a huge biomechanic issue there with the whole helmet shoulder pad thing. But no, the helmet is never was never intended to, nor does it currently do that. I have people that tell me all the time it can be done, and every time they email me to my inbox or whatever else on the blog, I tell them, well, why don't you show me the drawings, and I won't steal them, but let me see them, and I'll tell you whether or not this is going to work from a physics standpoint. I'm not a physics doctor or anything, but at the same time, it's pretty simple because the brain is resting. It's floating in your skull, and I don't know how you're going to stop that from moving around. I don't know.
Right. I don't think anybody does, because I don't think it's probably going to be possible.
No.
I want to ask you one last thing about risk reduction. And again,
Sure. Third
thing that is controversial. Now, this is an idea that has been floated, has not been really adopted anywhere in a systemic way. I've seen individual people adopt it, which is the idea of, let's not have children at least play tackle football until a certain age. Dr. Robert Cantu, who is one of the top sports concussion experts in the world, recently wrote a whole book talking about this, and basically says kids shouldn't play collision sports till they're 14. Yeah, I asked him in person, why 14? He basically said, you know, that's basically what he really meant. Not necessarily 14, but when you hit puberty, when you start getting those secondary sexual characteristics, the reason being, not only what you talked about earlier in terms of neck strength and physical strength, but also the brain itself, it really doesn't mature until your mid-20s. But when you're prepubescent, the biggest way to describe this is like the literal physical wiring in your brain, there's sort of a protective sheath and coating that grows over it, and that's not fully developed when you're prepubescent. So in some ways, scientists believe and feel strongly that your brain could be more vulnerable, that, you know, pediatric brain injuries can be worse, and that children are more vulnerable to these kinds of injuries. So that makes an argument, you know, don't start so early. Practically speaking, there are plenty of guys in the NFL who didn't play until high school football. Tom Brady is probably the best known person who's an example of this. I think personally, we're going to see more people getting on board with this idea, the idea of you just play flag football until high school. But again, there is another side of this argument. There are some people who make the same argument that you're setting these kids up to be in more danger if they start high school football because they never tackled before. They're going to get creamed. They're not going to know how to protect themselves. Again, from all the research and reporting I've done, I kind of fall into the camp of, you know what, this don't play collision sports until 14 sounds like a really good idea. The most compelling piece of evidence, by the way, for this, I just want to mention so people listening understand, doesn't come from football. It's actually from hockey. Hockey Canada recently banned body checking for 11 and 12-year-olds. The reason they did this is they did a study of two different provinces in Canada. One province with that age group, 11 and 12, had body checking. The other province didn't. There was a significantly larger number of concussions, obviously, in the body checking group. They estimate by making this change that they're going to prevent more than 1,500 concussions next season. To me, if that's good enough for hockey, and that's good enough in Canada, where hockey is God the way football is God in America, that's at least something here in America we should seriously look at. So all this is a long way to set up my question to you, which is, what do you think about the idea of an appropriate age to begin playing tackle football or even other collision sports and having the collisions be part of it?
I personally, as a father, prescribe to no collision sports, no hockey, full hockey, no football, rugby, that sort of thing, until high school. My sons will not play until the full contact, full collision stuff, till high school, unless there's some sort of dramatic change between now and then. I'm okay with that. I totally agree with what Dr. Cantu was saying. If you think about going back to our Jell-O example, your brain is a mold of Jell-O inside of your head. When you're younger, the Jell-O is similar. When you're born, the Jell-O is similar to the liquid that you mix in with the powder and the water, and before you put it in the fridge. And every, as it's starting to set up, that's at your brain. You can set up becoming more solidified through time until it's finally solidified until your mid-20s. If you get it rattled enough, you're going to shake up and move stuff in a certain spot in your mold. So if you have the traditional Christmas green Jell-O with the pear pieces in it, maybe you wanted a pear piece in a particular spot in mold. Well, if you bump that around when it's only been in there for an hour or two, and when they're youth, think of our football brains as youth, maybe that pair shifts a little bit and things change. So we've got to think about the malleability of the youth brain. We also have to think about, like you said, the overall skeletal and muscular strength of the individual when they're younger. Can they absorb these types of hits? Although not as frequent, they still happen. Are they able to? Also, knowledge of the game is another thing. Maybe not truly understanding, grasping the whole tackling technique that the coaches are trying to instill. The next thing is that the coaching is also better when you get older. And that's not a knock on the youth coaches. There's some great youth coaches out there. There's tons of them. But more often than not, those good coaches get moved up to the high school level, eventually the college level. It's like anything. So moving up in the world, more prestigious type things, the coaching is better, the safety is better. There's less, there's more understanding that this is school in football rather than just football after school with it is with youth sports. And then finally, when you start to get to the high school level, you're starting to see more proper medical care there for the athletes, i.e. athletic trainers, although only 42% of the most recent study we have is only 42% of all high schools have athletic trainers on game days, and I think it's even less than that. And it's like 30% of that 40 have athletic trainers for practices and games. At least you're starting to see them there at that level. All of that plays into the fact that maybe we should wait till we have better medical care, better coaching, better understanding, better physical maturity, and better maturity of the brain before we start throwing these kids out to get in all these collisions and possibly messing stuff. So yes, I stand on the side of I'm a big fan of that. I'm a proponent of it. And like I know in your article I was reading, Kevin Guskowitz, he's a great athletic trainer and a great researcher, and he's done good jobs and whatnot. But as he said, if you can't afford an athletic trainer, you shouldn't have collision sports. And so that basically throws out that whole youth sport group, unless it's club and they have the money to hire an athletic trainer. But even then, I still think having athletic youth football is better than having youth football athletic trainer. It's still a good choice, but it takes a lot of resources to pull this off. And if we're gonna do what we need to do, so I think why not wait? Why not wait? What are we harming by not waiting? That's what I don't get.
Well, what you're saying, it gets into potentially the ethical side of this question. So it's not just the practical side of should my kid play? Under what circumstances should they play? But there's a bigger question for society of should anyone's child be playing this? And the reason I think that it's a legitimate and important question that I don't think personally we've grappled with at all, really. We're just starting to, but we need to grapple with is because, look, we treat children and adults differently in a society. We
Yes,
have
we do.
highly different standards for what is an acceptable risk for children and what's an acceptable risk for adults. And there's many reasons for this. We're protective of children. Children can't give informed consent the way adults can. Their parents can give it. And in general, we just have a different standard. I want to ask you a couple questions about this. The first one gets to what you were just saying. So at the NFL level in particular, but also at the major college level, we've got in theory, the most physically mature players, they have the highest level of precautionary protection in theory because they've got trainers. They're on TV. There's lots of people watching. The NFL this year It's supposed to have independent neurologists on every sideline, looking specifically for concussions and signs of brain trauma. The most vulnerable population of football players, the largest population, which is youth players, like you said, a lot of high schools don't even have athletic trainers. When high schools don't have them, it's definitely the case that middle schools and youth teams do not have them. Do you think ethically this is a big problem? Is this a seriously troubling thing that we are not providing, the sport is not providing equivalent protection to the most vulnerable players?
Yeah, it's completely bass ackwards, because it from a logical standpoint, it makes no sense, that those that are most at risk and the most in danger of catastrophic type injuries are the least covered, but yet will spare no expense for those that are the most highly trained and at the top of the ladder. That's fine. That's great if they want to do that. But you know what? Start sharing your money, start spending your money, and start putting your efforts into making sure those that want to play your sport at a younger age are properly protected like they're professionals. And if you're not going to do that, then maybe the game shouldn't play the same exact way it is played at the professional level.
I'm glad you brought up money because there's another, that's another big part of this, which is those kind of protections are expensive. It's expensive to train and hire trainers. It's expensive to have this kind of monitoring. Medical care is expensive. There's this great quote. There's a very good journalist, Stefan Fatsis. He was with me at an Aspen Institute roundtable on youth football late last year, around this time. There was Everybody was there. There was NFL people, NFLPA people, experts in pediatric brain trauma. There were youth football people there. It was a big gathering of stakeholders, so to speak, in this subject. And we got towards the end of the afternoon, and he asked an incredibly good question. I'm going to read it to you in full. I'll read you the whole quote because I want to know what you think about this. This is what he said. He said, "You're talking about putting accelerometers in football equipment. You're talking about having equipment specialists outfit our children, having independent observers of coaches on the sidelines at practices and games to monitor what's going on. At what point are we kidding ourselves about youth football that this is not a sensible proposition when you need this kind of superstructure for every game in the country?" What do you think of that quote? What do you think of his point there?
It tells exactly what what I think as well, and that's that if we're saying that our players are the most protected and we're doing the best for our player safety, why aren't you doing the same for the youth? And if we can't do it for the youth because it costs so much money and it's such a big expense, why are we even having that? That's dead on. I feel as that is a very accurate statement, and I think it's something that, again, we have to. The fact that maybe it's not exactly right for everybody every second of the day, and it may not be right for a lot of people that want to do it because they can't afford it. It's just it's always been backwards to me. We're always saying we're doing this for the NFL, but we're not doing the same thing for the youth, high school, or college level. It seems like we're trying to trickle it down, but how can it trickle down when they don't have the money and the resources to do it?
Right, and that's, I think that's, when I look at, I've written many skeptical things about the NFL, and I think it's extremely earned skepticism, and anyone that doubts that really should go read the book, League in Denial. But one of the things that I'm particularly skeptical about when it comes to the NFL's sort of youth football safety and mom reassurance efforts is that I don't see them taking money and putting it into these kinds of things, these simple things like putting it into some sort of big fund so there are more athletic trainers going out there and advocating, even just saying you should have that or advocating for that. I don't see them really proposing any solutions to reduce risk that actually have a cost attached to them because I don't think they're very interested in having to expend any money if they don't have to. That's my soapbox. I think there's a lot more to that. I'd love to get into it sometime. We are running short on time right now, so let me get you out of here with one last question. Just really simple. Look into your crystal ball. Based on everything we talk about, what do you see sort of 10, 15 years down the road, maybe in 5 years down the road, with youth and high school football, what is it going to look like in terms of not just participation, but the kind of protections that we may have or that we may not have?
I think if we don't make proactive and sometimes what people classify as radical results, I think within 10 or 15 years, we're going to see a huge sharp decline in participation of the sport, which ultimately hurts the bottom line of big business of football. I think what I feel like should happen within that time frame is I think the big business of football are NFL, of the NFL. In fact, I tell the listeners here, I said as long as this podcast didn't interfere with my viewing of my favorite team, the Denver Broncos, that I would do this. So I still love the NFL. I don't feel like I'm a hypocrite. But the professional level is completely different than the youth level. I think the professional level needs, I don't know how to put a disclaimer on it, but you know, you watch MythBusters, they always tell you, we're trained professionals, don't do what we do at home, right? So maybe the NFL needs to start saying, hey, we're trained professionals, don't do what we do in terms of medical care at home type of thing. It's not safe for you until you're an adult type of thing. Some sort of disclaimer on that, and just totally separate and acknowledge the fact that they're professionals.
And they're adults. Different from you. They're adults.
Yes, and they're adults, and they have informed consent, and they're making the decision. I honestly have no problem with an NFL player understanding and fully understanding the injury other than concussion and the concussion, because they're not clearly thinking, obviously. But I have no problem with them if they know the risk. And I never had a problem with that. And that was what the whole League of Denial is all about. And this whole thing is that they didn't clearly know all the risks. But we can get to that some other time.
Sure.
But I think they're professionals. They need to be stated as such, and they don't. The trickle down effort that they want, they're getting, but they're getting the wrong message and the wrong things. And I think if the NFL poured some money in with some other help with other groups and stuff like that, you need to get. If the football is going to stick around in 10 or 15 years, maybe 20, you're going to have an athletic trainer. It's a simple. It's only going to be at the high school level.
Yeah.
Football for youth, premiums are going to be so high that only the most wealthy or those that can afford it will be able to become similar to polo at the youth sport level. It costs so much money to play polo because you have to have a horse and these huge grounds to play on that it's become exclusive at the youth level in 10 or 15 years. It's still going to be around, but it's not going to be around with the prevalence it is now. I also believe that you're going to see an increase in flag football, which I think is a good thing. Why not get more Johnnies and Sallies on the football field to love the game of football and become fans of football? Why not include the meat because of the hitting and the collisions? You're already shoving a portion of your legs to not be fans because they cannot participate. So there'll be increased flag football. It's win-win for everybody if they do it that way. And I think realistically it's going to happen, but I think change unfortunately is going to be forced upon us by other entities that have other money interests in what's going on here. So that's kind of what I see. It sounds like a convoluted mess, but that's kind of what I see is happening in the next 10 or 15 years. And I think it can be work. I think it's great for the sport. If we don't do it right, it's going to end up like or horse racing or polo. We don't want.
You know, and I think that's the big, you know, you mentioned boxing. That's, I think, the ultimate big fear at a lot of levels for, you know, the football industry is if this sport becomes a blood sport, the way boxing is a blood sport, and when I say a blood sport, seen as a blood sport culturally, then the sport loses the cultural cachet it has now. It is no longer going to be the somewhat, you know, rugged but wholesome all-American thing that Madison Avenue wants to ally itself with. It doesn't mean it's going to be extinct or be unprofitable or even unpopular, but all you have to do is look at the difference between boxing and MMA and football and sort of where they stand in popular culture and what that means for their bottom line to understand why the people who profit from the sport are terrified of falling. You know, right now, football's always kind of walked that tightrope And if they follow them around to the side where boxing and MMA are, it's going to mean a reduction in their bottom line, invariably. It's going to be a reduction in their cultural cachet.
Wouldn't you want to, if you run a business, when you're at or near your peak or what you've always peaked about, wouldn't you want to possibly make any radical changes at that point in time when you have the biggest following and the most money coming in and lose a few along the way because of those changes? That's fine because you're at your peak now and you can absorb that. Whereas waiting for a decline and then making a change and then shuffling a bunch of people away, if you do make that change at the peak, maybe you get those people back. Or maybe you get more people because of it and you increase your revenue and everything else over time. Why wouldn't you want that? And then at the same time, you could always change back a little bit if you've gone too far one way. You still have your core fans around. They're never going to lose their core fans, but they need to be careful because they're starting to lose their young fans and the moms. That, why do you think there's such a heavy push for the moms?
Oh, of
So,
course.
yes,
You know what?
I totally agree with that.
That's a great point. I think you made a great point. I'll just say to close things off here, the history of whether you're talking about big successful businesses, whether you're talking about big successful empires historically, whatever you're talking about, when there's a group or a business or something in an organization that has been incredibly successful, they always have a problem with change because there's just a lot of fear of change. You want to protect the status quo. It's very hard. Even for someone like you or me, look at it from the outside and say, oh, obviously you should make these changes. In the long run, it'll probably be better for your bottom line. It's very hard for them to see that. It's very hard to deal with disruption. I think we see that over and over again in industry. The industries that are the monopolies, the empires that are the most powerful, they almost never can deal with the disruption, even when they see it coming. And I don't know what that why that's probably something more about human nature than it is about football or any other sort of specific industry. Well, Dustin, look, we're out of time here. This has been great. There's
I'm sorry.
honestly, no, don't be sorry. There's so much more we could talk about. But the thing is, I will definitely have you on again. In the
Right.
meantime, tell people how they can find your blog and how they can find you on Twitter.
Sure. The blog is theconcordia.com.
So
You
I
can
think you
go
just
there and
broke
check
up
out
there.
the
Sorry.
links.
You broke up, so give
It's
that to me again.
theconcussionblog.com. Is my website, is a blog, and it's a fairly, I hope it's a good read for most people. And then on Twitter, you can catch me at concussionblog. Hit me with any questions or whatever else. I'm not afraid of debate, so have at it and get a hold of me.
Yeah, I want to let people out there know. Look, Dustin and I have talked before, obviously, and he gets questions from parents all over the country trying to make this choice or asking questions about their kid when they've suffered a concussion or just questions trying to understand more about this issue. And I know that Dustin gets back to the people that write to him. And like I said, he's a great resource. If he doesn't know the answer, he will find someone to help you. Again, I'm not trying to get a million people to write to you now, but seriously, like his site's a great, great resource. It's theconcussionblog.com and on Twitter at Concussion Blog. Dustin, this has been excellent. Thank you again. We will definitely talk again because I know the subject is not going away anytime soon. In the meantime, for Sports on Earth, I'm Patrick Ruby, saying goodbye, Ruby Tuesday.